Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Do you have kids who went to college or who are thinking about going to college, maybe grandkids, or maybe they didn't and you are wondering about the wisdom of all of that? You know, there's this notion that college isn't for everybody, but the question is, does it give you the biggest advantage in life? There's the $64,000 question. The guy that's writing about that has written the book How Children Succeed. You may remember that from a few years ago. Paul Tuff is in our studio. He is speaking with Alex Kotlowitz at the Harold Washington Library on State Street tonight at 6 o'clock. It's free and open to the public. Boy, there are two powerhouse thinkers and writers, and one of them sitting right next to me right now. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How Children Succeed. A great title. I mean, who wouldn't feel compelled to pick that up?
Right.
I suppose the writing helped get it on the New York Times bestseller list, too. And it was a little counterintuitive, right? You said in that book that it's not just IQ, but really grit and determination that drives children to success.
Yeah, what economists sometimes call non-cognitive skills, curiosity, optimism, grit, that those things matter at least as much as IQ, maybe more so.
Are they innate?
Well, no. It seems like there's a lot in a child's environment, how they grow up, what they're surrounded by, that affects those qualities. And especially when young people grow up in really stressful environments, it's hard for them to develop the same kind of persistence.
How do you define success in How Children Succeed?
Well, I mean, in some ways, I was just using the economist's definition, which is how much money you make as an adult. But I think we can all agree that's a slightly narrow version. And so I think it's having opportunities, being able to follow whatever kind of dream you have as an adult. Some kids are able to choose from lots of different things. Some aren't.
It's funny. I have some friends who have made through their life and now as they approach and go into retirement, financial decisions that were not in their best financial interest. And the thing that bugs me about them is they seem happier than me, and I'm always trying to maximize my revenue streams.
Right.
So maybe I'm doing it wrong and they're doing it right.
I mean, I think a lot of happiness in life just has to do with your attitude. And I think that's true in childhood and on the way into college as well.
But I was wondering, as I was reviewing your first book, if you would prioritize, though, the attributes that would make it most likely that you would have a good life. So, okay, it's not IQ. It's some of these other things. But isn't IQ one of the most important tools in the box?
It's one of them. I just think that we have put it way out of proportion. And the way that we measure success in school, it really just focuses on that narrow band of cognitive skills that get measured on standardized tests. There's a lot else out there.
Would you list them, though? Like if you had one trait that you would gift your child with, what would it be?
I do think persistence is a big one. I mean, I think the ability to deal well with failure and setbacks, that is just true in anyone's life.
That could overcome a lot of the other shortcomings, right?
Absolutely.
How do you ingrain that in a child?
I mean, I think it's partly by example. So I have a 4-year-old and a 10-year-old, and I think about this all the time with them. And, you know, I want them to be able to bounce back more from failures. And then I watch them watching me have trouble bouncing back from failures. I think that's a big part of it.
Is that a burden to put on your kids that you're the... You've written about the value of these traits. By golly, they'd better measure up.
I hope not. I mean, I think the book tries to take a more holistic vision of childhood and says, you know, don't just label your kid with one particular number. So I try to do that with mine as well.
Your latest book is The Years That Matter, How College Makes or Breaks Us. If you want to cry in 9 pages, read the first 9 pages of this book. About a young lady who is waiting to find out if she gets into Penn or Princeton, and the call she gets from her friend. And I just went, oh, here it comes, and it came. So what do you say in this, The Years That Matter Most?
So the years that I'm talking about in this book are the years right after high school. So college is a big part of it, but I think whatever decisions young people make in those years after high school and what decisions more often are made for them, what economists tell us now is that those are highly important, highly predictive of how the rest of their lives are going to go. And this is also a time on a personal level when young people are sort of figuring themselves out. And so we have created a system of social mobility where all of this pressure is on young people who are at a particularly fragile and easy to influence time of life.
Okay, so it's difficult for them, and maybe we've put too much pressure on them, if that's what you're saying. But is it better that you go to college than you not go to college?
I mean, the short answer is yes. So right now, when the college wage premium, how much more college graduates make than someone who's just gone to high school, it is as high as it has ever been in American history. College degrees are extremely valuable. You know, it depends on who you are, where you go, how you do, what kind of major you take. But on the whole, college really does pay off.
Are we diminishing, literally or figuratively, the value of the trades?
Well, I mean, two things about that. One is a lot of those trades you still need to go to college. So when I'm talking about college, I'm not just saying, you know, four-year liberal arts degrees. I followed this one student at a community college in North Carolina as he was trying to make his way to a welding degree.
So CVCC.
Exactly.
And I was thrilled that you wrote about that. And you remind us that to get a degree and to be a welder, you need a degree probably from a JC.
Yeah. And so this was at this in this era a couple of years ago when a lot of the political rhetoric around college focused on welding and said, like, you don't need to go to college. There's this alternative. You can become a welder, make $150,000 a year. And this young man, Ori, was kind of in the middle of that frenzy about welding. And so in watching him make his way through or try to make his way through Catawba Valley Community College, it gave me some perspective on that rhetoric about welding. And it made me question a lot of it.
What's the truth about a career as a welder?
Well, you can make a lot of money as a welder. Some do, but the average, the median wage for welders is $41,000 right now, which is, you know, not bad if you're just starting out, but most of those welders are, you know, men in their 40s and 50s trying to support a family, and that is not a fantastic wage. So a lot of what I try to do in that chapter is not put down welding. I think it's an amazing trade, and
necessary.
It was fun watching Ori get better at it, but it's the rhetoric that we've put around it. We have, I think, convinced young people that it's an alternative to college. It doesn't mean, and I think that lets us wash our hands of kids like Ori.
Wash our hands? Why do you say that? What if he wants to be a welder? What if he's a good welder? What if that brings him happiness?
Well, that's great. I just think that. And I think he should. And I think we should have a great community college, better funded community college that will let him do that. But I think that the reality is for young people like him who didn't particularly like high school and get out of high school, the options right now that we have given those young people are pretty bad. We just have not developed a system that lets them get to a career that's going to pay them the kind of wage that will let them have a middle class life and support a family. And that has to do with big changes in the economy. That, you know, no one person is able to control. It's just how honest we're being with those people and how hard we're working to develop a system that will help them get somewhere good.
What do you have in mind?
Well, I mean, I think community colleges are a big part of it. I mean, during the time that Ori was looking into community college, North Carolina, where he lived, was cutting the amount that they were spending on their community colleges from about $5,000 to about $4,000 per student. You know, in high school, students were spending $15,000 or $20,000 on, and then you get to the next stage of your educational career, and suddenly we won't spend any money on you at all. But, you know, the community colleges were designed to be the place where people get both skills that'll let them go on to a four-year school or the kind of skills that'll let them go directly into a trade.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I was an example. Many of my friends, because I went there for 2 years, are examples of people that went to the JC for 2 years, got a very good, very inexpensive education at Joliet Junior College, and then you go on to wherever you go on, but you sort of skip at least 2 years of expensive school when you go to a JC. And I got as good as learning at the junior college as I did the four-year school.
It's a great model, and it's exactly what I think, you know, young people coming out of Chicago public schools should have that opportunity right now. But when you look at the data from Chicago City Colleges, the graduation rates, the persistence rates onto four-year schools are not impressive at all.
You cite a study in your book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Paul Tuff is in our studio. He's speaking with Alex Kotlowitz at the Harold Washington Library at 6 o'clock tonight. You cite some studies and you say if you go to an uber elite school, you have a very good chance of being rich in life. If you go to an Ivy Plus school, Ivy and maybe University of Chicago, mm-hmm. your chances are pretty good too. And it's commensurate, isn't it? The eliteness, if you will, of the school with the probability that you will make a lot of money in life. True?
True. And the reason I think that that matters is that there's also a correlation between the selectivity of your school and how many rich kids are going to that school.
Right. So it's almost preordained. The way I didn't realize this. I thought the Yales and the University of Chicago's were very good about reaching out to middle class or minority students. But the way you write about it, they're just picking the cream of the crop, and they're predisposed to being successful and rich.
Yeah, I think those institutions focus in their public relations a lot on the socioeconomic diversity of their classes. But this economist named Raj Chetty did an amazing study where he analyzed it using tax records, and he found that at schools like Princeton and Yale, like not much more than 2% of each class is from the bottom quintile, is from low-income families.
2%?
Yeah.
Not even 2% is from the bottom quintile.
Exactly.
Meaning the bottom 20% wage earners, not
right.
The bottom 2%.
Exactly.
Up to the okay.
Yeah, and I feel like that is, the story is
then
that
there are
lots of those students.
I bought into that. I thought it was about half and half.
No, and in fact, in that top quintile, about, I think at Princeton, it's about almost 75% of the class comes from that top quintile. So there's a lot of rich kids at these schools.
It's 222 on WGN. You may have a question or comment, an observation about all of this. And I wonder what Paul Tough thinks the lesson to be learned is from the college admissions scandal and what he thinks of 14 days in jail for cheating. 312-981-7200-WGN. Paul Tough's in our studio, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. So, by the way, how college makes or breaks us. College makes us, right? I mean, that's the idea. You would advise people to, if you can, go to college, right?
Yes, but I think the system as a whole is doing a lot of damage to the country as a whole right now. So the us in Makes or Breaks Us is both individual students who can really suffer if they take the wrong path through college, and the country, which is dealing with the fact that higher education has become so stratified that there are certain institutions that serve mostly affluent kids, and everybody else is going to students that have much lower graduation rates, much less money invested in them.
Are kids taking the wrong majors? Do you worry that kids are graduating with degrees that don't pay off?
Yeah, to a certain degree. I mean, I think it's a really difficult decision for any young person. There are certain degrees that are clearly like very vocational, you know, like that welding degree, nursing degrees, lots of things that are very specific. There's a reason to take those because they do pay off, but they also don't last as long. And I do think that there's an advantage to getting the kind of general liberal arts education that matters so much in a knowledge economy.
John, I have a master's. My girlfriend has a 2-year degree. She's a dental hygienist, and she makes 6 figures and as much as I do with my master's degree. What's your comment on that?
Sounds like a good couple.
You're done right.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's not a direct correlation between how much education you get and how much money you make. But in general, it's true. You know, having a master's degree will, on average, pay off with a higher salary.
What is the moral of the story of the college admission scandal?
I think it is that the kind of competitive pressure that we have put on higher education admissions is driving kids and parents a little bit crazy. I think we have sort of forgotten this idea that it was at the root of public higher education, which is that it's a collective, right? Like it's a collective good. We now think of higher education as a consumer good, something that we have to compete for. And given that it's an unfair situation, I think a lot of parents just say, like, there are no rules. I'll do whatever I can to get my kid in.
What advice do you have to parents then?
To take it easy, to chill out a little bit, and to think in a different way about what higher education is, to think of it not just as something where the job is to elbow everyone else out of the way, but think about how your choices affect not just your own child, but the broader community.
I don't know what that means, the broader community. I think what they should think about is, can I afford to pay for it? And do I strap the kid with a loan that we're all going to regret after they graduate?
I think that's part of it, yeah. I mean, you know, what you were talking about looking financially, looking at community colleges, at junior colleges for the first couple of years, looking at public institutions, I think all of that is smart. It makes sense to not think of it in sort of through magical thinking, but to think of it as a good like anything else. But I also think we have to think about higher education not just as something that we buy for our own kids, but that we invest in as in the public. I mean, our public higher education system used to be free or cheap, and that was a way that we were educating students. That's why they were able to get out without a lot of debt.
Should it be? Democrats like that. Hillary liked it. Bernie likes it. I don't know where the rest of them are, but that notion is floating to either forgive all student loans or make through the 16th grade college free. What do you think about that?
I think some of those plans are going a little far, but I think the basic idea of returning to what we had a few decades ago when public higher education was free or almost free is the right approach. I mean, you know, 100 years ago, we built all of our high schools because we believed that students needed to get to 12th grade in order to join the middle class, and we made it free. Now things have changed. It's 100 years later, and you need more than a high school degree in order to succeed. But we say to kids, it's on you. You pay for it. You figure it out. We're not going to treat this as a public.
Paul, you're singing my song. This would have been if 60 years ago we said we'll only get you to the 8th grade, but you really need 12th. We didn't do that. We said you needed to get to the 12th grade. The goal lines moved, and it's now $200,000 to get there, and we don't seem to acknowledge that, which I think is a shame. Everything you said notwithstanding, there's cheaper ways to do it, but
you're right.
When I get to be king, at least junior college degrees, your first 2 years would be free. I don't know if I'm going to be able to finance that, but I could probably get elected with that.
Yeah, I wrote about this era in American history called the high school movement that was more than 100 years ago, and it was remarkable. It was like the technology changed. Communities realized that a 6th grade, 8th grade education wasn't enough, and all of these communities came together and built high schools. In 1910, about 10% of students were graduating from high school. By 1940, 50% were graduating. And it was just this response by the country to the fact that their kids needed more education.
Those were the high school graduation rates?
Exactly.
Do those again, 1910?
So 1910, it was 10% of students graduating from high school. You didn't need a high school.
And in World War II, in 1940, it was what?
By then, it was 50%.
I'm shocked that it was only 50 high school. We're out of time. Paul Tough, The Years That Matter Most. He wrote How Children Succeed. 6 o'clock tonight at the Harold Washington Library, 400 South Street, with Alex Kotlowitz on stage talking about stuff like this. What a pleasure, Paul. Keep writing and do join us in the studio again.
Thank you very much.